rather than heard the heavy footfalls in the dirt behind her. She looked over her shoulder. The horse stopped, freezing like a statue. Swan continued after Josh, and the horse followed at a respectful distance at its own ambling pace. The terrier darted out and yapped a couple of times, just for the sake of being nettlesome, and the piebald horse kicked its hind hooves backward in disdain and showered the dog with dirt. Leona was sitting on the ground, massaging her knees. Josh's light was coming, and when they appeared from the field, she saw Swan and the horse in the beam's backwash. "Lord almighty, what'd you find?"
"This thing was running wild out there," Josh told her, helping her to her feet. "Swan charmed the horseshoes right off him, got him settled down."
"Oh?" Leona's eyes found the little girl's, and she smiled knowingly. "Did she?" Leona hobbled forward to look at the horse. "Must have belonged to Homer. He had 3 or 4 horses out here.
Well, he's not the handsomest animal I've ever seen, but he's got 4 strong legs, don't he?" "Looks like a mule to me," Josh said. "Those hooves are as big as skillets."
He caught a whiff of decay from the Jaspin farmhouse. The horse's head jerked, and he whinnied as if he'd smelled death as well.
"We'd better get out of this wind."
Josh motioned toward the barn with his lantern. He put the pistol and the lantern back in the wheelbarrow and went on ahead to make sure whoever had killed Homer and Maggie Jaspin wasn't hiding in there waiting for them. He wondered who Lord Alvin was, but he was surely in no hurry to find out. Behind him, Swan picked up her bag and crybaby, and Leona followed her with her suitcase. Trailing them at a distance was the horse, and the terrier yapped at their backs and began to roam around the farmyard like a soldier on patrol. Josh checked the barn out thoroughly and found no one else there. Plenty of hay was strewn about, and the horse came inside with him and made himself at home. Josh unpacked the blankets from the wheelbarrow, hung the lantern from a wall, and opened a can of beef stew for their dinner. The horse sniffed around them for a while, more interested in hay than in canned stew. He returned when Josh opened a mason jar of well water, and Josh poured a bit out for him in an empty bucket. The horse licked it up and came back for more. Josh obliged him, and the animal pawed the ground like a newborn colt.
"Get out of here, mule," Josh said when the horse's tongue tried to slip into the mason jar.
After most of the stew was gone and just the juice remained, Swan took the can outside and left it for the terrier, as well as the rest of the water from the mason jar. The dog came to within 10 feet, then waited for Swan to go back into the barn before coming any closer. Swan slept under one of the blankets. The horse, which Josh had christened Mule, ambled back and forth, chomping on hay and peering out through the cracked door at the dark farmhouse. The terrier continued to patrol the area for a while longer, then it found a place to shelter against one of the outside walls and lay down to rest.
"Both of them were dead,"
Leona said as Josh sat against a post with a blanket draped over his shoulder.
"Yeah."
"Do you want to talk about it?"
"No, and neither do you. We've got another long, hard day tomorrow."
She waited for a few minutes to see if he would tell her or not, but she really didn't want to know. She pulled her blanket over her and went to sleep. Josh was afraid to close his eyes because he knew what was waiting for him behind the lids. Across the barn, Mule rumbled quietly. It was an oddly reassuring sound, like the noise of heat coming through a vent into a cold room, or a town crier signaling that all was well. Josh knew he had to get some sleep, and he was about to close his eyes when he detected a small movement just to his right. He stared and saw a little roach crawling slowly over the scattered bits of hay. Josh balled up his fist and started to slam it down on the insect. but his hand paused in midair. "Everything alive's got its own way of speaking and knowing," Swan had said. "Everything alive." He stayed the killing blow, watching the insect struggle tenaciously onward, getting caught in pieces of hay and working itself loose, plowing forward with stubborn, admirable determination. Josh opened his fist and drew his arm back. The insect kept going, out of the light's range and into the darkness on its purposeful journey. "Who am I to kill such a thing?" he asked himself. "Who am I to deliver death to even the lowest form of life?" He listened to the keening of the wind whistling through holes in the walls, and he pondered the thought that there might be something out there in the dark, God or devil or something more elemental than either, that looked at humankind as Josh had viewed the roach, less than intelligent, certainly nasty, but struggling onward on its journey, never giving up, fighting through obstacles or going around them, doing whatever it had to do to survive. And he hoped that if the time ever came for that elemental fist to come crashing down, its wielder might take a moment of pause as well. Josh drew the blanket around himself and lay down in the straw to sleep. Chapter 38.
"This is our power," Colonel Macklin said, holding up the .45 automatic he'd taken off the dead young man from California.
"No," Roland Croninger replied. "This is our power." And he held up one of the bottles of pills from Sheila Fontana's drug cache.
"Hey!" Sheila grabbed at it, but Roland held it out of her reach. "That's my stash. You can't..."
"Sit down," Macklin told her.
She hesitated, and he rested the pistol on his knee.
"Sit down," he repeated.
She cursed quietly and sat down in the filthy pit while the kid continued to tell the one-handed war hero how the pills and cocaine were stronger than any gun could ever be. Dawn came with a cancerous yellow sky and needles of rain. A black-haired woman, a man with one hand in a dirty overcoat, and a boy wearing goggles trudged across the landscape of rotting corpses and wrecked vehicles. Sheila Fontana was holding up a pair of white panties as a flag of truce, and close behind her, Macklin kept the .45 aimed at the small of her back. Roland Croninger, bringing up the rear, carried Sheila's knapsack. He remembered how the woman's hair had felt in his hands, how her body had moved like a roller coaster ride. He wanted to have sex again, and he'd hate it if she made a wrong move now and had to be executed. Because, after all, they'd shown her the highest chivalry last night. They'd saved her from the rabble, and they'd given her some food, dog biscuits they'd been living on from the wreck of a camper, the dog's carcass having been consumed long ago, and a place to rest after they were done with her. They reached the edge of the dirt-wart land and started across open territory. Ahead of them lay the tents, cars, and cardboard shelters of the privileged people who lived on the lakeshore. They were about halfway across, heading for a battered, dented Airstream trailer at the center of the encampment, when they heard the warning shout,
"Dirt wart's coming in! Wake up! Dirt wart's coming in!"
"Keep going," Macklin told Sheila when she faltered. "Keep waving those panties, too."
People started coming out of their shelters. In truth, they were every bit as ragged and dirty as the dirt warts, but they had guns and supplies of canned food and bottled water, and most of them had escaped serious burns. The majority of dirt warts, on the other hand, were severely burned, had contagious illnesses, or were insane. Macklin understood the balance of power. It was centered within the Airstream trailer, a shining mansion amid the other hovels.
"Turn back, fuckers!"
a man hollered from a tent's entrance. He aimed a high-velocity rifle at them.
"Go back!"
a woman shouted, and someone threw an empty can that hit the ground a few feet in front of Sheila. She stopped, and Macklin pushed her on with a shove of the automatic.
"Keep moving. And smile."
"Go back, you filth!" A second man, wearing the remnants of an Air Force uniform and a coat stained with dried blood, shouted. He had a revolver, and he came within 20 feet of them.
"You grave robbers!" he shouted. "You dirty, lice-ridden heathen!"
Macklin didn't worry about him. He was a young man, maybe in his mid-20s, and his eyes kept sneaking toward Sheila Fontana. He wasn't going to do anything. Other people approached them, shouting and jeering, brandishing guns and rifles, knives, and even a bayonet. Rocks, bottles, and cans were thrown, and though they came dangerously close, none of them connected.
"Don't you bring your diseases in here," a middle-aged man in a brown raincoat and woolen cap hollered.
He was holding an axe.
"I'll kill you if you take another goddamn step."
Macklin wasn't worried about him either. The men were puzzled by Sheila Fontana's presence, but he recognized the lust on their faces as they surged around, hollering threats. He saw a thin young woman with stringy brown hair, her body engulfed in a yellow raincoat, and her sunken eyes fixed on Sheila with deadly intent. She was carrying a butcher knife, fingering the blade. Macklin did feel a pang of worry about her, and he guided Sheila away from the young woman. An empty can hit him in the side of the head and glanced off. Someone came close enough to spit on Roland.
"Keep going, keep going," Macklin said quietly, his eyes narrowed and ticking back and forth.
Roland heard shouts and taunting laughter behind them, and he glanced over his shoulder. Back in the dirt wart land, about 30 or 40 dirt warts had crawled from their holes and were jumping up and down, screaming like animals in expectation of a slaughter. Macklin smelled salt water. Before him, through the misting rain and beyond the encampment, the Great Salt Lake stretched to the far horizon. It smelled antiseptic, like the halls of a hospital. The stump of Macklin's wrist burned and seethed with infection, and he longed to plunge it into the healing water, to baptize himself in cleansing agony. A burly, bearded, red-haired man in a leather jacket and dungarees, a bandage plastered to his forehead, stepped in front of Sheila. He aimed a double-barrel shotgun at Macklin's head.
"That's as far as you go."
Sheila stopped, her eyes wide. She waved the pair of panties in front of his face.
"Hey, don't shoot. We don't want any trouble."
"He won't shoot," Macklin said easily, smiling at the bearded man.
"See, my friend, I've got a gun pointed at the young lady's back. If you blow my head off, and if any of you dumb fucks shoot either me or the boy, my finger's gonna twitch on this trigger and sever her spine. Look at her, fellas. Just look. Not a burn on her. Not a burn anywhere. Oh, yeah. Fill your eyes full, but don't touch. Isn't she something?"
Sheila had the impulse to pull her T-shirt up and give the gawkers a tit show. If the war hero had ever decided to give pimping a try, he'd have racked up. But this whole experience was so unreal. It was almost like flying on a tab of LSD, and she found herself grinning, about to laugh. The filthy men who stood around her with their guns and knives just stared, and further behind them was a collection of skinny, dirty women who watched her with absolute hatred. Macklin saw they were about 50 feet from the Airstream trailer.
"We want to see the fat man," he told the guy with the beard.
"Sure." The other man hadn't lowered his shotgun yet, his mouth curled sarcastically.
"He sees dirt warts all the time, serves them champagne and caviar," he snorted. "Who the fuck do you think you are, mister?"
"My name is Colonel James B. Macklin. I served in Vietnam as a pilot, and I was shot down and spent 1 year in a hole that makes this place look like the Ritz-Carlton. I'm a military man, you dumb bastard."
Macklin's face was reddening. "Discipline and control," he told himself. "Discipline and control makes the man." He took a couple of deep breaths. Around him, several people jeered at him, and someone's spit landed on his right cheek.
"We want to see the fat man. He's the leader here, isn't he? He's the one with the most food and guns."
"Run him out!"
a stocky, curly-haired woman shouted, brandishing a long barbecue fork.
"We don't want their damn diseases!"
Roland heard a pistol being cocked, and he knew someone was holding a gun just behind his head. He flinched, but then he turned slowly around, grinning rigidly. A blonde-haired boy about his age, wearing a bulky plaid jacket, was aiming a .38 right between his eyes.
"You stink," the blonde-haired kid said, his dead brown eyes challenging Roland to make a move.
Roland stood very still, his heart going like a jackhammer.
"I said, we want to see the fat man," Macklin repeated. "Do you take us or what?"
The bearded man laughed harshly.
"You've got a lot of guts for a dirt wart."
His eyes flickered toward Sheila Fontana, lingered on her body and breasts, then went back to the pistol Macklin held. Roland slowly lifted his hand in front of the blonde kid's face. Then, just as slowly, brought his hand down and reached into the pocket of his trousers. The blonde boy's finger was on the trigger. Roland's hand found what he was after, and he began to draw it out.
"You can leave the woman and we won't kill you," the bearded man told Macklin. "Just walk out and go back to your hole. We'll forget that you even..."
A little plastic bottle hit the ground in front of his left boot.
"Go ahead," Roland told him. "Pick it up. Take a sniff."
The man hesitated, glanced around at the others who were still shouting and jeering and eating Sheila Fontana alive with their eyes. Then he knelt down, picked up the bottle Roland had tossed over, uncapped it, and sniffed.
"What the hell? Want me to kill him, Mr. Lowry?"
the blonde kid asked hopefully.
"No, put that damn gun down."
Lowry sniffed the contents of the bottle again, and his wide blue eyes began to water.
"Put the gun down," he snapped,
and the boy obeyed reluctantly.
"You gonna take us to the fat man?"
Macklin asked. "I think he'd like to get a sniff, don't you?"
"Where'd you get this shit?"
"The fat man. Now."
Lowry capped the vial. He looked around at the others, looked back at the Airstream trailer, and paused, trying to make up his mind. He blinked, and Roland could tell the man didn't exactly have a mainframe computer between his ears.
"Okay," he motioned with a shotgun. "Move ass." "Kill him," the stocky woman shrieked. "Don't let him contaminate us."
"Now listen, all of you."
Lowry held the shotgun at his side and kept the plastic vial gripped tightly in his other hand.
"They're not burned or anything. I mean, they're just dirty. They're not like the other dirt warts. I'll take responsibility for them."
"Don't let them in,"
another woman shouted.
"They don't belong."
"Move," Lowry told Macklin. "You try anything funny and I swear to God, you'll be one headless motherfucker. Got it?"
Macklin didn't answer. He pushed Sheila forward, and Roland followed him toward the large silver trailer. A pack of people stalked at their heels, including the trigger-happy kid with a .38 revolver. Lowry ordered them to stop when they'd gotten 10 feet from the trailer. He walked up a few bricks that had been set up as steps to the trailer's door and knocked on it with the butt of his shotgun. A high, thin voice from inside asked,
"Who is it?"
"Lowry, Mr. Kempka, I've got something you need to see."
There was no reply for a moment or so. Then the whole trailer seemed to tremble, to creak over a few degrees as Kempka, the fat man who Macklin had learned from another dirt wart was the leader of the lakeshore encampment, approached the door. A couple of bolts snapped back. The door opened, but Macklin was unable to see who had opened it. Lowry told Macklin to wait where he was, then he entered the trailer, the door shut. As soon as he was gone, the curses and jeers got louder, and again, bottles and cans were flung.
"You're crazy, war hero," Sheila said. "You'll never get out of here alive."
"If we go, so do you."
She turned on him, disregarding the pistol, and her eyes flashed with anger.
"So kill me, war hero. As soon as you pull that trigger, these horny bastards will take you apart piece by piece. And who said you could use my stash, huh?
That's high-grade Colombian sugar you're throwing around, man.
Macklin smiled thinly. You like to take chances, don't you? He didn't wait for an answer because he already knew it. You want food and water? You want to sleep with a roof over your head and not expect somebody to kill you in the night? You want to be able to wash and not squat in your own shit? I want those things, too, and so does Roland. We don't belong out there with the dirt warts. We belong here, and this is a chance we've got to take. She shook her head, and though she was infuriated at losing her stash, she knew he was right. The kid had shown real smarts in suggesting it.
You're crazy.
We'll see. The trailer's door opened. Laurie stuck his head out.
Okay, come on up.
But you give me the gun first. No deal. The gun stays with me.
You heard what I said, mister.
I heard. The gun stays with me. Laurie looked over his shoulder at the man inside the trailer, then.
Okay, come on, and be quick about it.
They went up the steps into the trailer, and Laurie closed the door behind Roland, sealing off the shouts of the mob. Laurie swung a shotgun up at Macklin's head. A blob, wearing a food-stained T-shirt and overalls, was sitting at a table on the other side of the trailer. His hair was dyed orange and stood up in inch-high spikes on his scalp, and he had a beard streaked with red and green food coloring. His head looked too small for his chest and massive belly, and he had four chins. His eyes were beady black holes in a pallid, flabby face. Scattered around the trailer were cases of canned food, bottled Cokes and Pepsis, bottled water, and about 100 six-packs of Budweiser stacked up against one wall. Behind him was a storehouse of weapons, a rack of seven rifles, one with a sniper scope, an old Thompson submachine gun, a bazooka, and a variety of pistols hanging on hooks. Before him on the table, he had sifted a small mound of cocaine from the plastic vial and was rubbing some of it between his fleshy fingers. Within reach of his right hand was a Luger, its muzzle pointed in the direction of his visitors. He lifted some of the cocaine to his nostrils and sniffed delicately, as if testing French perfume.
"Do you have names?" he asked, in a voice that was almost girlish.
"My name is Macklin, Colonel James B. Macklin, ex-United States Air Force. This is Roland Croninger and Sheila Fontana." Kempka picked up another bit of cocaine and let it drift back down.
"Where did this come from, Colonel Macklin?"
"My stash," Sheila said.
She thought she'd seen all the repulsive things in the world, but even in the low yellow light of the two lamps that illuminated the trailer, she could hardly bear the fat man. He looked like a circus freak, and from each of his long, fat earlobes hung diamond-studded earrings.
"And this is the extent of that stash?"
"No," Macklin replied. "Not nearly all. There's plenty more cocaine and all kinds of pills, too."
"Pills?" Kempka repeated, his black eyes aimed at Macklin. "What kind of pills?"
"All kinds. LSD, PCP, painkillers, tranquilizers, uppers and downers." Sheila snorted.
"War hero, you don't know shit about goodies, do you?"
She took a step toward Kempka, and the fat man's hand rested on the Luger's butt.
"Black beauties, yellow jackets, blue angels, bennies, poppers, and red stingers, all high-quality floats."
"Is that so? Were you in the business, young lady?"
"Yeah, I guess so."
She looked around at the messy, cluttered trailer.
"What kind of business were you in? Pig farming?"
Kempka stared at her. Then slowly, his belly began to wobble, followed by his chins. His entire face shook like a plate full of jello, and a high feminine laugh squeaked between his lips. He said, his cheeks reddening.
"Pig farming."
He waved a fat hand at Lowry, who forced a nervous laugh as well. When he'd stopped laughing, Kempka said,
"No, dear one. It was not pig farming. I owned a gun shop in Rancho Cordova.
just east of Sacramento. Fortunately, I had time to pack up some of my stock and get out when the bombs hit the Bay Area. I also had the presence of mind to visit a little grocery store on the way east. Mr. Lowry was a clerk at my store, and we found a place to hide for a while in the El Dorado National Forest. The road brought us here, and other people started arriving. Soon, we had a little community. Most of the people came to soak themselves in the lake. There's a belief that bathing in the salt water washes off the radiation and makes you immune. He shrugged his fleshy shoulders. Maybe it does. Maybe it doesn't. In any case, I kind of enjoy playing King of the Hill and the Godfather. If someone doesn't do as I say, I simply banish them to Dirtwood Land, or I kill them. He giggled again, his black eyes sparkling merrily. You see, I make the laws here. Me, Freddy Kempka, lately of Kempka's Shootist Supermarket Incorporated. Oh, I'm having a real ball.
Good for you, Sheila muttered.
Yes, good for me.
He rubbed cocaine between his fingers and sniffed a bit up each nostril.
My, my, that is a potent dust, isn't it?
He licked his fingers clean, and then he looked at Roland Croninger.
What are you supposed to be, a space cadet?
Roland didn't answer.
I'll zap your big fat ass, he thought.
Kempka giggled.
How come you to be out in the dirtwort land, Colonel?
Macklin told him the whole story, how Earth House had collapsed and how he and the boy had gotten out. Macklin made no mention of the Shadow Soldier, because he knew the Shadow Soldier didn't like to be talked about to strangers.
I see, Kempka said when he'd finished. Well, like they say, the best laid plans often go shitty, don't they? Now, I suppose you came here and brought this potent dust for a purpose. What is it?
We want to move into the encampment. We want a tent, and we want a supply of food.
The only tents that are here were brought on people's backs. They're all filled up. No room in the inn, Colonel.
Make room. We get a tent and some food, and you get a weekly ration of cocaine and pills. Call it rent.
What would I do with drugs, sir?
Roland laughed, and Kempka regarded him through hooded eyes.
Come on, mister. Roland stepped forward. You know you can sell those drugs for whatever you want. You can buy people's minds with that stuff, because everybody'll pay to forget. They'll pay anything you ask. Food, guns, gasoline, anything.
I already have those things.
Maybe you do, Roland agreed.
But are you sure you've got enough of them?
What if somebody in a bigger trailer comes into the encampment tomorrow? What if they've got more guns than you do? What if they're stronger and meaner? Those people out there,
he nodded toward the door, are just waiting for somebody strong to tell them what to do.
They want to be commanded. They don't want to have to think for themselves.
Here's a way to put their minds in your pocket.
He motioned to the snowy mound. Kempka and Roland stared at each other for a silent moment, and Roland had the sensation of looking at a giant slug. Kempka's black eyes bored into Roland's, and finally, a little smile flickered across his wet mouth.
Would these drugs, he said, buy me a sweet young space cadet?
Roland didn't know what to say. He was stunned, and it must have shown on his face because Kempka snorted and laughed. When his laughter was spent, the fat man said to Macklin,
"What's to keep me from killing you right now and taking your precious drugs, Colonel?"
"One simple thing. The drugs are buried out in the dirtwort land. Roland's the only one who knows where they are. He'll go out and bring you a ration once a week, but if anybody follows him or tries to interfere, they get their brains blown out." Kempka wrapped his fingers on the tabletop, looking from the mound of cocaine to Macklin and Roland, contemptuously dismissing the girl, and then back to the Colombian sugar.
"We could use that stuff, Mr. Kempka," Lowry offered. "Fella came in yesterday with a gas heater that sure would warm this trailer up.
Another guy's got some whiskey he lugged along in a tow sack. We're going to need tires for the truck, too. I would have already taken that heater and the bottles of Jack Daniels, but both of those new arrivals are armed to the teeth. Might be a good idea to trade drugs for their guns, too.
I'll decide what's a good idea and what's not.
Kempka's face folded up as he frowned thoughtfully. He drew a long breath and exhaled it like a bellows.
Find them a tent, close to the trailer, and spread the word that if anybody touches them, they answer to Freddy Kempka.
He smiled broadly at Macklin.
Colonel, I believe you and your friends are going to be very interesting additions to our little family. I guess we could call you pharmacists, couldn't we?
I guess so. Macklin waited until Lowry had lowered his shotgun, and then he in turn lowered the automatic.
There. Now we're all happy, aren't we?
And his black, ravenous eyes found Roland Croninger. Lowry took them to a small tent staked down about 30 yards from the Airstream trailer. It was occupied by a young man and a woman who held an infant with bandaged legs. Lowry stuck the shotgun in the young man's face and said, "Get out." The man, drawn and gaunt, hollow-eyed with fatigue, scrabbled under his sleeping bag. His hand came up with a hunting knife, but Lowry stepped forward and caught the man's thin wrist beneath his boot. Lowry put all his weight down, and Roland watched his eyes as he broke the man's bones. They were empty, registering no emotion, even when the snapping noise began. Lowry was simply doing what he'd been told. The infant started crying, and the woman was screaming, but the man just hugged his broken wrist and stared numbly up at Lowry.
Out. Lowry put the shotgun's barrel to the young man's skull. Are you deaf, you dumb bastard?
The man and woman wearily got to their feet. He paused to gather up their sleeping bags and a knapsack with his uninjured hand, but Lowry grabbed him by the scruff of the neck and hauled him out, throwing him to the ground. The woman sobbed and cringed at her husband's side. A crowd was gathering to watch, and the woman shrieked,
"You animals! You dirty animals! That's our tent! It belongs to us!"
"Not anymore." Lowry motioned with the shotgun toward the dirtwort land. "Start walking."
"It's not fair. Not fair."
The woman sobbed. She looked around imploringly at the people who were gathering. Roland, Macklin, and Sheila did too, and they all saw the same thing in those faces, an impassive, uninvolved curiosity, as if they were watching television violence. Though there were faint expressions of disgust and pity here and there, the majority of the onlookers had already been shocked, devoid of all emotion.
"Help us," the woman begged. "Please, somebody help us."
Several of the people had guns, but none of them intervened. Macklin understood why. It was the survival of the fittest. Freddy Kempka was the emperor here, and Lowry was his lieutenant. Probably one of many lieutenants Kempka used as his eyes and ears.
"Get out," Lowry told the couple.
The woman kept shrieking and crying, but finally the man stood up and, his eyes dead and defeated, began to trudge slowly toward the grim land of car hulks and decaying corpses. His expression turned to hatred. She stood up with the wailing infant in her arms and shouted to the crowd,
"It'll happen to you. You'll see. They'll take everything you have. They'll come and drag you out of..."
Lowry struck out with the stock of his shotgun. It crunched into the infant's skull, the force of the blow knocking the young woman to the ground. The infant's crying abruptly stopped. She looked down into her child's face and made a weak, choking sound. Sheila Fontana couldn't believe what she'd just witnessed. She wanted to turn away, but the scene had a dark hold on her. Her stomach churned with revulsion, and she could still hear the infant's cry echoing over and over in her mind. She put her hand over her mouth and pressed. The young man, a corpse in clothes, was walking on across the plain, not even bothering to look back. Finally, with a shuddering gasp, the woman rose to her feet, the silent infant clasped to her chest. Her hideous, hollowed-out eyes met Sheila's and lingered. Sheila felt as if her soul had been burned to a cinder. If only the baby had stopped crying, Sheila thought. If only... The young mother turned and began to follow her husband into the mist. The onlookers drifted away. Laurie wiped the stock of his shotgun on the ground and motioned toward the tent.
"Looks like we just got a vacancy, Colonel."
"Did you have to do that?" Sheila asked. Inside, she was trembling and sick, but her face showed no sign of it, her eyes cold and flinty.
"Every once in a while, they forget who makes the rules. Well, do you want the tent or not?"
"We do," Macklin said.
"There you go, then. Even got a couple of sleeping bags and some food in there. Cozy as home, huh?"
Macklin and Roland entered the tent.
"Where am I supposed to live?" Sheila asked Laurie.
He smiled, examined her up and down.
"Well, I've got an extra sleeping bag over in the trailer. See, I bunk with Mr. Kempka, but I'm not funny. He likes young boys, couldn't give a shit about women. What do you say?"
She smelled his body odor and couldn't decide whose was worse, his or the war hero's.
"Forget it," she said. "I'll stay here."
"Suit yourself."
"I'll get you, sooner or later. When hell freezes."
He licked a finger and held it up to catch the wind.
"It's getting pretty frosty, darling."
Then he laughed and sauntered off toward the trailer. Sheila watched him go. She looked in the direction of the dirtwort land and saw the vague outlines of the young couple heading into the mist, into the unknown that lay beyond it. Those two wouldn't have spitz chance out there, she thought. But maybe they already knew that. The baby would have died anyway, she told herself. Sure, the kid was half dead already. But that incident had knocked her off her tracks more than anything ever had before, and she couldn't help thinking that a few minutes before, there was a living person where a ghost was now. And it had happened because of her drugs, because she'd come in there with the war hero and the punk playing big shots. The young couple disappeared into the gray rain. As Rudy said, you cover your own ass. And in this day and time, those were words to live by. Sheila turned her back on the dirtwort land and slipped into the tent. Chapter 39.
"Light!" Josh shouted, pointing into the distance. "Look at that! There's light ahead!"
They'd been following a highway over gently rolling country, and now they saw the light that Josh pointed toward, a bluish-white illumination reflecting off low-lying, turbulent clouds.
"That's Matheson," Leona said from her bareback perch atop Mule. "Lord almighty, they've got the electricity on in Matheson."
"How many people live there?" Josh asked her, speaking loudly over the rushing pull of the wind.
13,000, 14,000. It's a regular city."
"Thank God. They must have fixed their power lines. We're going to have hot meals tonight, thank God."
He started shoving the wheelbarrow with newfound energy, as if his heels had sprouted wings. Swan followed him, carrying the dousing rod in her small bag, and Leona kicked her heels into Mule's sides to urge the horse onward. Mule obeyed without hesitation, glad to be of use again. Behind them, the little terrier sniffed the air and growled quietly, but followed nevertheless. Flickers of lightning shot through the cloud cover over Matheson, and the wind brought the rumble of thunder. They'd left the Jaspin farm early that morning, had walked all day along the narrow highway. Josh had tried to put a saddle and bridle on Mule, but though the horse stood docilely, Josh couldn't get the damned things on right. The saddle kept slipping, and he couldn't figure out how to get the bridle on at all. Every time Mule had even grumbled, Josh had jumped back out of the way, expecting the animal to buck and rear. And finally, he gave the job up as a lost cause. Still, the horse accepted Leona's weight without complaint. He had also borne Swan for a few miles. The horse seemed content to follow Swan, almost like a puppy, and off in the darkness, the terrier yapped every once in a while to let them know he was still around. Josh's heart was hammering. That was one of the most beautiful lights he'd ever seen. Next to the glorious flashlight beam that had speared through the basement. Oh, Lord, he thought, a hot meal, a warm place to sleep, and glory of glories, maybe even a real toilet again. He smelled ozone in the air. A thunderstorm was approaching, but he didn't care. They were going to rest in the lap of luxury tonight. Josh turned his face toward Swan and Leona. Lord God, we made it back to civilization. He let out a loud whoop that put the wind to shame and even made Mule jump. But the smile froze on Leona's face. Slowly, it began to slide off. Her fingers curled through Mule's coarse black mane. She wasn't sure what she'd seen, wasn't sure at all. It had been a trick of the light, she told herself. A trick of the light, yes, that's all. Leona thought she'd seen a skull where Josh Hutchins' face had been. But it had been so fast, there and then gone in an eye blink. She stared at the back of Swan's head. Oh, God, Leona thought, what'll I do if the child's face is like that, too? It took her a while to gather her courage, and then she said, Swan? In a thin, scared voice. Swan glanced back. Ma'am? Leona was holding her breath. Ma'am? Swan repeated. Leona found a smile. Oh, nothing, she said, and she shrugged. The vision of a skull beneath the skin wasn't there. I just wanted to see your face, Leona told her.
My face? Why? Oh, I was just thinking how pretty you must have been.
She stammered at her own error.
I mean, how pretty you're going to be again once your skin heals up. And it will, too. Skin's a real tough thing, you know. Sure is. It'll heal up pretty as a picture.
Swan didn't answer. She remembered the horror that had stared back at her from the bathroom mirror.
I don't think my face'll ever heal up, she said matter-of-factly.
A sudden awful thought struck her.
You don't think...
She paused, unable to spit it out. Then,
you don't think I'll scare people in Matheson, do you?
Of course not. And don't you even think such a thing. In truth, Leona hadn't considered that before. But now, she could envision residents of Matheson cringing away from Josh and Swan.
Your skin'll heal up soon enough, Leona assured her. Besides, that's just your outside face.
My outside face?
Yep. Everybody's got two faces, child. The outside face and the inside face. The outside face is how the world sees you, but the inside face is what you really look like. It's your true face. And if it was flipped to the outside, you'd show the world what kind of person you are.
Flipped to the outside? How? Leona smiled.
Well, God hasn't figured a way to do that yet, but he will. Sometimes you can see a person's inside face, but only for a second or two, if you look close and hard enough. The eyes give away the inside face, and likely as not, it's a whole lot different than the mask that's stuck on the outside.
She nodded, looking toward the lights of Matheson.
Oh, I've met some mighty handsome people who had monstrous ugly faces on the inside, and I've met some homely folks with buck teeth and big noses and the light of heaven in their eyes. And you know that if you saw their inside faces, the beauty would knock you right to your knees. I kind of figure it might be like that for your inside face, child. And Josh's as well. So what does it matter about your outside face?
Swan pondered for a moment.
I'd like to believe that. Then take it as true, Leona said, and Swan was quiet.
The light beckoned them onward. The highway climbed over one more hill, then began to curve gently down toward the town. Lightning jumped across the horizon. Beneath Leona, mule snorted and whinnied. Swan heard a nervous note in the horse's whinny. Mule's excited because we're going to find more people, she thought. But no. No. That hadn't been a sound of excitement. Swan had heard it as a distrust, edginess. She began to pick up the horse's nervousness. To feel a little wary herself, like the time she'd been strolling across a wide golden field and a farmer in a red cap had yelled, "Hey, little girl, watch out for rattlers and them weeds." Not that she was afraid of snakes, far from it. Once, when she was 5 years old, she'd picked up a colorful snake right out of the grass, run her fingers across the beautiful diamonds on its back and the bony-looking ridges on its tail. Then she'd set the snake down and watched as it crawled unhurriedly away. It was only later, when she told her mama and gotten a rear-blistering whipping in return, that Swan had realized she was supposed to be afraid. Mule made a whickering sound and tossed his head. The road flattened out as it approached the outskirts of town, where a green sign proclaimed, "Welcome to Matheson, Kansas. We're strong, proud, and growing." Josh stopped, and Swan almost bumped into him.
"What is it?" Leona asked him.
"Look," Josh motioned toward the town. The houses and buildings were dark. No light came from their windows or front porches. There were no street lights, no headlights of cars, no traffic lights. The glow that reflected up off the low clouds was coming from deeper within the town, beyond the dead, dark structures that were scattered on both sides of the main highway. There was no sound but the shrill whine of the wind.
"I think that light's coming from the center of town," he told Swan and Leona. "But if the electricity's back on, why aren't there lights in the house windows, too?"
"Maybe everybody's in one place," Leona offered, "like at the auditorium or city hall or somewhere."
Josh nodded.
"There ought to be cars," he decided. "Ought to be traffic lights working. I don't see any."
"Maybe they're saving the electricity. Maybe the wires aren't too strong yet."
"Maybe,"
Josh replied. But there was something spooky about Matheson. Why were there no lights in the windows? Yet something at the center of Matheson ablaze with light. And everything was so still, so very still. He had the feeling that they should turn back. But the wind was cold and they had come so far. There had to be people here, sure. They're all in one place, like Leona had suggested. Maybe they're having a town meeting or something. In any case, there was no turning back. He started pushing the wheelbarrow again. Swan followed him, and the horse that bored Leona followed Swan, and off to the left, the terrier kept to the tall weeds and ran ahead. Another roadside sign advertised the Matheson Motel, swimming pool, cable TV, and a third sign said the best coffee and steaks in town could be found at the Hightower Restaurant on Cavener Street. They followed the road between plowed fields and past a dark softball diamond and a public school where the lounge chairs and umbrellas were blown into a chain-link fence. A final roadside sign announced the July firecracker sale at the Kmart on Billups Street, and then they entered Matheson. It had been a pretty town, Josh thought as they walked along the center line. The buildings were either made of stones or logs meant to resemble a frontier town. The houses were made of brick, most of them one story, nothing fancy, but nice enough. A statue of somebody on his knees, one hand covering what might have been a Bible, and the other extended toward the sky, stood atop a pedestal in a district of small shops and stores that reminded Josh of that Mayberry show with Andy Griffith. A canopy flapped over a store with a barber pole in front of it, and the windows of the Matheson First Citizens Bank were broken out. Furniture had been dragged out of a furniture store, piled in a heap in the street, and set afire. Nearby was an overturned police car, also burned to a hulk. Josh didn't look inside. Thunder growled overhead, and lightning danced across the sky. Further on, they found a used car lot. "Trade at Uncle Roy's," the sign urged. Under rows of flapping multicolored banners were six dusty cars. Josh began to check them all one by one as Swan and Leona waited behind and Mule grumbled uneasily. Two of them were sitting on flat tires, and a third's windshield and windows were shattered. The other three, an Impala, a Ford Fairlane, and a red pickup truck, seemed in pretty good shape. Josh walked to the small office building, found the door wide open, and with the light of the bullseye lantern, located the keys to all three vehicles on a pegboard. He took the keys out to the lot and methodically tried them. The Impala wouldn't make a sound, the pickup truck was dead, and the Fairlane's engine popped and stuttered, made a noise like a chain being dragged along gravel, and then went silent. Josh opened the Fairlane's hood and found that the engine had been attacked with what might have been an axe, the wiring, belts, and cables hacked apart. "Damn it," Josh swore, and then his lantern revealed something written in dried grease on the inside of the hood. "All shall praise Lord Alvin." He stared at the scrawled writing, remembering that he'd seen the same thing, though written in a different hand and in a different substance, at the Jaspin farmhouse the night before. He walked back to Swan and Leona, and he said, "Those cars are shot. I think somebody wrecked them on purpose." He looked toward the light, which was much closer now. "Well," he said finally, "I guess we go find out what that is, right?" Leona glanced at him, then quickly away. She wasn't sure that she hadn't seen the skull again. But in this strange light, she couldn't tell. Her heart had begun to pump harder, and she didn't know what to do or say. Josh pushed the wheelbarrow forward. Off in the distance, they heard the terrier bark a few times, then silence. They continued along the main street, passing more stores with broken windows, more overturned and burned vehicles. The light pulled them onward, and though they all had their private concerns, they were drawn to that light like moths to a candle. On a corner, with a small sign that pointed to the right and said, "Pathway Institute, 2 miles," Josh looked in that direction and saw nothing but darkness.
"That's the asylum," Leona said.
"The asylum?" The word lanced him. "What asylum?"
"The crazy house. You know, where they put folks who go off their rockers. That one's famous all over the state, full of people too crazy to go to prison."
"You mean the criminally insane?"
"Yeah, that's right."
"Great," Josh said. The sooner they were out of this town, the better. He didn't like being even 2 miles from an asylum full of lunatic murderers. He peered off into the darkness where the Pathway Institute was, and he felt the flesh ripple all up and down his backbone. And then they went through another area of silent houses, passing the dark Matheson Motel and the Hightower Restaurant, and they entered a huge paved parking lot. Before them, every light illuminated and blazing, was a Kmart, and next to it, a similarly lit food giant supermarket. "God almighty," Josh breathed, "a shopping center." Swan and Leona just stared, as if they'd never seen such light or huge stores before.
Dark-sensitive photon lamps cast a yellow glow over the parking lot, which held perhaps 50 or 60 cars, campers, and pickup trucks, all covered with Kansas dust. Josh was completely stunned and had to catch his balance before the wind knocked him over. It was running through his head that if the electricity was on, then the freezers in the supermarket would be operating too, and inside would be steaks, ice cream, cold beer, eggs, bacon, ham, and God only knew what else. He looked at the brilliantly lit Kmart, his brain reeling. What sort of treasures would be in there? Radios and batteries, flashlights and lanterns, guns, gloves, kerosene heaters, raincoats. He didn't know whether to laugh or sob with joy, but he pushed the wheelbarrow aside and started walking toward the Kmart as if in a delirious daze. "Wait," Leona called. She got down off mule and hobbled after Josh. "Hold up a minute." Swan set her bag down but kept hold of Crybaby and followed Leona. Behind her, Mule plodded along. The terrier barked a couple of times, then slipped under an abandoned Volkswagen and stayed there, watching the humans moving across the parking lot. "Wait!" Leona called again, but she couldn't keep pace with him, and he was heading for the Kmart like a steam engine. Swan said, "Josh, wait for us," and she hurried to catch him. Some of the windows were broken out of the Kmart, but Josh figured the wind had done that. He had no idea why the lights were on there and nowhere else. The Kmart and the supermarket next to it were akin to water holes in a burning desert. His heart was about to blast through his chest. Candy bars, he thought wildly. Cookies, glazed donuts. He feared his legs would collapse before he reached the Kmart, or that the entire vision would tremble and dissolve as he went through one of the front doors. But it didn't. And he did, and there he stood inside the huge store with the treasures of the world on racks and displays before him, the magic phrases snacks and candy and sporting goods and automotives and housewares on wooden arrows pointing to various sections of the store. "My God," Josh said, half drunk with ecstasy. "Oh, my God." Swan came in, then Leona. As the door was swinging shut, a blurred form darted in, and the terrier shot past Josh and vanished along the center aisle. Then the door shut, and they stood together in the glare, while Mule whinnied and pawed the concrete outside. Josh strode past a display of outdoor grills and bags of charcoal to a counter full of candy bars. His desire for chocolate fanned to a fever. He sucked three Milky Ways right out of their wrappers and started on a half-pound bag of M&Ms. Leona went to a table piled with thick athletic socks. Swan wandered amid the counters, dazzled by the amount of merchandise and the brightness of the lights. His mouth crammed with gooey chocolate, Josh turned to a display of cigarettes, cigars, and pipe tobacco. He chose a pack of Have a Tampa Jewels. Found some matches nearby, struck one of the cigars between his teeth, and lit it, inhaling deeply. He felt as if he'd stepped into paradise, and the pleasures of the supermarket were yet to be experienced. From far back in the store, the terrier yapped several times in rapid succession. Swan looked back along the aisle but couldn't see the dog. She didn't like the sound of that barking, though. It carried a warning. And as the terrier began to bark again, she heard it yip as if it had been kicked. A barrage of barking followed. "Josh," Swan called. A cocoon of cigar smoke obscured his head. He puffed on the stogie and chewed more candy bars. His mouth was so full he couldn't even answer Swan. He just waved to her. Swan walked slowly toward the back of the store as the terrier continued to bark. She came to three mannequins, all wearing suits. The one in the middle had on a blue baseball cap, and Swan thought it didn't go at all with the suit, but it might be made to fit her own head. She reached up and plucked it off. The entire waxen-fleshed head toppled from the mannequin's shoulders, right out of the stiff white shirt collar, and fell to the floor at Swan's feet with a sound like a hammer whacking a watermelon. Swan stared wide-eyed, the baseball cap in one hand and crybaby in the other. The head had thinning gray hair and dark socketed eyes that had rolled upward, and on its cheeks and chin was a stubble of gray whisk